A lot can happen in 3 years, like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage that lasts nearly 3 years in some states. Learn more at uh1.com.
It's that time of the year. Your vacation is coming up. You can already hear the beach waves, feel the warm breeze, relax, and think about work. You really, really want it all to work out while you're away. Monday.com gives you and the team that peace of mind. When all work is on one platform and everyone's in sync, things just flow. Wherever you are, tap the banner to go to Monday.com.
You're listening to Justice with me, prison philanthropist and founder of One Small Thing, Edwina Grosvenor. In the series of Justice, we will explore the experiences of mothers in the justice system, from women who enter prison pregnant and give birth inside, to those who are separated from their children for imprisonment and involvement from social services. Each episode, I'll be speaking to expert guests and exploring what needs to change. In this episode, I speak to Becky Ray and Katia Parent, social workers who are part of the pilot project run by the Prison Advice and Care Trust that sees social workers being based inside women's prisons for the first time.
Hi, my name's Becky. I am a social worker based at HMP Eastwood Park, which is in the southwest of England. Eastwood Park is a remand and sentence prison, so we have quite a big population and it's very transient. We also have a mother and baby unit.
And I'm Katia, and I'm a social worker at HMP Send, which is in Surrey, kind of South London way. And we have a much smaller prison, about, I think we're at 170 women right now, which is very different. And we don't hold anyone on remand. So longer sentences, life sentences, people have been there for quite some time. So very different between me and Becky.
Okay, and Becky, how many did you say roughly in the prison that you work in?
It's about 350.
Okay.
So, yeah, much, much bigger.
Okay. And there's mother and baby units in both prisons?
Not in mine, no.
Okay, but there is...
At mine.
So could you explain to me exactly what the role is of a social worker in a prison? Because we've had many discussions with different people who work with mothers and babies and the perinatal and afterwards. There's so many different areas and different sort of members of staff, as it were. So can you explain to me what a social worker does in a prison?
Bit of a loaded question, isn't it?
Probably depends on the day and what's going on. But
we're kind of making it up as we go, aren't we? Because we're working on this pilot project. So there's only the two of us who are social workers in prison. So our main goal is to work with mothers who have their children usually involved with social services out in the community. So it's kind of bridging the gap between community social services and the prison.
Yeah, and I think is sometimes that involves promoting contact and challenging local authority decision making, where we sort of feel that that reflects the best interests of the child. But sometimes it means explaining to mum who's in custody or supporting her through the process of understanding why she's perhaps not going to be able to parent in the way that she wants to, and helping her to understand the decisions that have been made by social services, by family courts, and sort of giving her that social work lens so that she can understand that.
What age do you start sort of working? I mean, the age of the child or the baby, is it sort of from any age?
Yeah, so it'd be birth to 18.
Okay.
I know I've worked with a few women who their kids are young adults now or have disabilities and are 19, 20 and still need a bit of support. So I think we're quite flexible around that. We support a large range.
Again, that sort of comes with the pilot, I suppose. Mm-hmm. We do have that flexibility at the moment to pursue where we perceive areas of need. Mm-hmm. Obviously, with Eastwood Park as well, there is an element of, I mean, I'm sure it would be the same with you in unborn cases as well, but particularly because we have the mother and baby unit, there's perhaps more options for us to explore in terms of what happens if mum is pregnant and is going to be giving birth in custody.
Okay.
Sen won't have anyone that's pregnant. As a general rule, because Bronzefield is so close by, so they tend to go there instead.
Okay.
So for us, I mean, it would probably be, zero to 18.
Okay. So in Send, then, if there's no sort of pregnant women or they get sort of moved, what is your sort of usual day-to-day sort of caseload? Because I presume the women that are there, their children have either been removed off them into care, and they're trying to maybe think about getting them back if they're going to be released soon.
Yeah.
Or the child might be with a family member.
Yeah. I work with a family engagement worker who takes on the cases of when they're with family. So I'm only involved with the ones that have social services involved. So that can look like children who are in foster care, long-term foster care, in the process of being adopted under an SGO, so a special guardianship order. A lot of women who are going through court to find the right order for the children when social services are trying to remove them. So a day-to-day, what does a day-to-day look like? A lot of meetings with the girls and trying to find out where they're at, what kind of contact they have with their kids and what they want ideally, and looking if that's possible. So I reach out to social services on the outside to find out why they're involved with the children, what led to social services being there, and trying to put that together with the offence of that woman and seeing what is right in the best interest of the children.
Okay. Because, of course, you will have cases, I imagine, where it is appropriate that the separation remains for the safety of the child, perhaps, and then other times when it doesn't probably make any sense at all, right?
Exactly. I think between Becky and I, we do have quite a few women where contact is not appropriate. And it's kind of our job to speak to these women and explain the reality of that and try to get them to come to terms with the grief of losing the children and how they can still remain mothers despite not having contact with their children.
Right.
Or the level of contact that they want to have. So this is a huge spectrum of what contact looks like. And you know, the vast majority of mothers would be wanting face-to-face, you know, quality, meaningful contact with their children, and that's not always going to happen. So if, for example, it's felt best that the child not have face-to-face contact, but they perhaps can exchange letters or cards or speak on the phone, then it's sort of trying to help mum, I suppose, to make those things as meaningful as possible and accept that that's where things are at the moment.
Okay. And then I guess it's up to the child, is it, when they reach 18, if they want to establish contact then as an adult?
Or earlier, potentially, yes.
Oh, really?
So, yeah, social services will, if the situation arises where, for example, the child is, let's say, 14, 15 and is saying, I want to have more contact with my mum, then social services, if they're involved, would consider that. They would, again, there would need to be a risk assessment. There would need to be analysis of that situation. But obviously a 15-year-old child is very much a part of their care.
So
their voice is important.
Right.
I think that's the beauty of our job too, is because we facilitate those conversations between mom and social services. We tend to find out what the child thinks and what they've shared with their social worker. So the social worker might come to us and say, you know what, this child is thinking about potentially having contact, can we explore what that would look like? Contact can be, again, letters or phone calls or just sharing pictures. So we have those conversations with social services to find out where the child is at, and then we relay that back to mom and prepare her for whatever outcome that might be, either it's a positive one or a negative one.
Mm. And what, I mean, I know, again, there's going to be no one answer to this, but the sort of, I suppose, the emotional stage the women are at when they're sort of talking about these things, do you find, because having worked with women in prison for, you know, a long time in my life, I know that a lot of people can be resigned and quite numb and seem quite sort of cut off, or you have the sort of the opposite end of the spectrum. Where do you generally find women are?
In ways, we experience a bit of difference, I think, because of our populations.
Yeah.
So because Eastwood Park accepts women on remand, we will have women come in right off the street.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas that's not so much the case in Katia's prison, because the women that come to her have already been on remand and been sentenced.
Yes, they're a bit more stable in a sense.
Perhaps, yes.
Not maybe emotionally stable, but
their situation is more
stable than yours.
Yeah. So they will have gone through court.
A lot of the women that come to us on remand or on a recall, there's a lot of uncertainty. There's a lot of instability. They don't know perhaps where their children are. There are lots of points of crisis for them at that moment in time, and that tends to reflect in their behaviour. Others, not so much, but we do see that. I think I probably see that a lot more than you do. That's one of the big differences, I think, between
I would
our
say
populations.
So. Yep.
And because of that, it means that I can have, as I said at the start, a much more transient population. So I might have women come in who are only going to be with us for 4 weeks, 3 weeks, 2 weeks. They're still in that crisis. It doesn't matter that they're only going to be here for 21 days, 28 days. They still feel that desperate need for support and for help and for some sort of clarity. And at that point, we're just really trying to work out what's the most meaningful and impactful thing that we can do with this really little amount of time.
And in a way, that time is even more urgent, isn't it? Where they only have such a short amount of time, but that can be like catastrophic on a family unit. So it's even more important to get those the support and the connections in place and maintain the bond if they're going to be in prison for 2, 3, 4 months. Whereas when they come to me, they might have 4, 5, 10 years to do. So they're in a very different emotional state.
And again, that state, it ebbs and flows, doesn't it? Mm-hmm. It depends, you know, life is not linear, and it could be that things are stable and really consistent and everyone's happy with the arrangement that's in place for 2, 3 years, and then suddenly something happens and those things change. The child decides they don't want contact. Mum perhaps moves to another prison, and then suddenly contact isn't as easy to facilitate and things have to be reviewed. A child's placement breaks down, and all of a sudden we're thrown back into distress and uncertainty.
I've certainly heard stories from women, and this shouldn't be the case, but of course lots of things happen that sort of shouldn't happen. And this lady told me she had 4 children removed off her when she went to prison for a first-time offence, non-violent, abusive, coercive husband, you know, sort of usual story, sadly. And then she was told her children were going to be adopted when she was in prison, adopted away from her. She would have been out after about a year. So of course that should not have been the case. But that's what they said to her. And they also said to her when she got to prison, she had 4 children. They said, you can have 1 phone call. So she had to choose which child she had to call. You know, and the story goes on and it's horrific. And I wondered how much you hear that, or whether that is actually quite rare in the grand scheme of things, even though we know these things do go on.
I think they are rare in my prison because the kids who are being adopted, their moms are used serving life or are going to be there for a long time. But usually when it's a shorter sentence, it's very difficult for social services to adopt children. I'm going through a process right now with one of my mums who gave birth in prison, and the child is coming up to 2 and the adoption is still not complete and she will be in prison for life. So adoptions tend to take a very long time in court. So it's very difficult for social services to get that. But it could very well be that when they start off, they say, well, we're going to do that because you've got a prison sentence. So let's just go to that. It might change over the course of the next few months or years.
Obviously, we can only really speak for the prisons that we work in. It's a tricky situation because obviously, if children are really young, then cases are typically twin-tracked anyway. Adoption will always be considered as, think of it like a plan B. So they might be exploring options for the child to stay within the family, et cetera, et cetera. But they will also be looking at twin-tracking an adoption alongside that as an alternative.
Okay.
To make sure that the child, you know, the child is cared for,
yeah,
and there is going to be some permanence for this child. Without obviously knowing too much details, it could be that that was what happened. They twin track. There wasn't any alternative options. There's so much complexity. And I think it's difficult. And this is part of why our work is so important, because a lot of the time when I speak to mums about their cases, they don't recall all of the details. The details that they do recall are not necessarily what I, as a social worker, as a professional, would consider a key detail. It's what they, as mum, in her emotional state, remembers. And so when they tell me these stories, whilst I have so much sympathy and compassion, and it sounds like a horrific experience, and I'm with them in that, and I can see that in their faces, it's difficult to take that as being the complete narrative, which is why we then go to social services, mm-hmm. we contact family courts, and we get all of that information to really understand why these decisions were made.
Yes.
There is a legal framework that is being complied with
and
somewhere.
I guess there's so much interpreting that has to go
absolutely.
On. Because even me, who sort of worked in it for years, always learning from people like you and sort of going, oh God, yeah, there's that other bit I hadn't quite thought about and that other bit. And I think so much of the time is just sort of trying to understand the process, isn't it? And as you say, if someone's in an emotional state, you're not going to be, you know, if you're looking at having your children removed off you, I mean,
they can't be expected for you to understand what's happening. And that's where we come in, is we're able to dig with social services. Well, why was this said to mom, or what was said to mom? Why are the kids removed? What happened before her prison sentence? So we actually get to understand why things are where they are and how we can sometimes challenge those decisions or try to change things.
Yeah, it's not to invalidate a mother's experience of mm-hmm. what happened. It's to give clarity.
Yeah.
we'll often say to people when they say, you know, what do you spend most of your time doing? What's the biggest part of your job? And I will usually say to people, I feel like an interpreter and a translator most of the time. I'm getting information, like I said, from the local authority, from the courts, and relaying that back to mum, reading through orders and statements, and explaining to her in non-professional jargon,
right? Exactly, yeah.
What it is that this is saying, what people are saying, why they're saying it. You know, where this is coming from, what the motives
are, and all that too.
Yeah, and what that means for them. Yeah. And with that comes empowerment. Like, knowledge is power. Like, if they totally understand what's happening.
And also, I guess it's that awful thing of, if you do have to deliver the worst news, which is your children will be adopted, but I'm afraid this is the end of the line. I mean, obviously completely horrific, but sometimes knowing and then being able to grieve and deal with that is really important, as opposed to just not knowing for ages and having that sort of hanging over you. I mean, both would be awful, let's be honest.
Absolutely.
And do you have to deliver that news? That's what interests you.
This is what I say all the time, is that at the end of the day, these people did something wrong, but they're not bad people, and they still deserve our honesty, and they deserve us to just say it how it is. And just explaining, you know, this is your situation, and unfortunately this is what's going to need to happen, but I will support you through that, and here are other things that we can look at. You might not have the contact that you want with your children. Your children might not want to see you because things you may have done to them, but you deserve to know that. And the only way that this person can move on and grieve and get the emotional support that they need and get the counseling is by getting the truth and actually knowing where they stand. So I think a lot of social services in the community will be afraid to have those conversations with these women. They're afraid of what it's going to mean, what the impact is going to be, how emotionally distraught they'll be after. And, you know, this whole prison is a different universe that they don't understand. So we actually get to build relationships with these women and explain, this is where things are. It's not good, but let's use it and get to a better place.
Yeah. So we work for a charity, we work for the Prison Advice and Care Trust. And I think that with that comes a level of independence. So when we approach women, when we're building relationships with women, there isn't the threat of the local authority. It's a bit of a challenge for them to wrap their heads around the fact that we are social workers, and a lot of the time that comes with negative thoughts.
Yeah, and stigma.
A lot of assumptions and fear. Absolutely, yeah. A lot of these women either have had experiences of social services in their own childhoods, or perhaps with children previously, if not currently. And so there's a challenge there, but there is also that assumption that social workers are in the local authority, and we are not. So we almost come in as someone who knows the system, who knows these processes, who knows the legal frameworks that are being worked within, but is there to support them and is there to use that information, not to get them what they want, but is there to use that information to help them and to guide them through a really, really difficult time.
Okay. And is that different to your traditional social worker? Right. And can you explain that difference?
So Becky and I have both worked for a council before.
Okay.
So we know how things work when you're in the council. You know, you have 24 hours to write your note. You have 10 days to see them. You have to do that. And the information you get when you're talking to families is, well, it's called investigation, isn't it? You're getting information to protect the children, which is crucial work. It's necessary. But when you're looking at the prisoners, they just need the support to understand why social services are doing things a certain way. So we kind of come in a bit of a neutral place where we explain how things work on the outside, but we're there to support them and looking at the best interest of the child at the end of the day. So we can explain that to both parties, to both social services in the community and the prison, and be that more of a supportive person for them.
Was the training through your organisation that you work with now that takes you from being the traditional social worker to this sort of more, I don't want to say more compassionate, but the more kind of,
the work is more creative.
For the woman.
Yeah, the work is a lot more creative and flexible. I think part of that comes from working in a pilot, even just things like being here.
Yeah, right.
I would never have done this as a local authority social worker. And if I had, it would have probably gone through
a lot of channels to get permission.
Yeah, absolutely. Exactly. So there's a lot more freedom in that sense. And it just means that we're able to really look at each case, each woman, and sort of find, this goes back to the question that you asked us at the start, what does a social worker do? I also think social workers are often gap fillers. Mm-hmm. We find the areas that other people aren't, and we sort of slot ourselves in there.
I think to simplify it, we kind of pick up where there's a gap and we're the middleman between the prison and the community social workers, aren't we? We do what isn't done for them. We support the women who don't have social services supporting them, because social services on the outside are helping the kids and are there for the kids. But that leaves mom in the dark. And we kind of pick that up a little bit.
So how many women do you work with, Katia?
On my caseload, I think I have about 20 or 25.
Okay, and you, Becky?
I have, I think, high 20s at the moment.
Okay.
So, yeah,
is that
usually
an average
around 30.
Caseload?
Yeah.
Yeah. Ideally, it would be a little bit lower.
Right, okay.
The vision for the project was small caseloads, which would give us scope for really intensive working. But that's not always how things work in practice. For me, going into Eastwood Park and there being tens and tens and tens and tens and tens of women who are eligible, I suppose, for my service, who would meet the criteria for my service, as opposed to a different part of the family service in our prison. It's really hard.
Where do you draw the line?
To say, no, can't right now. Or especially if there's urgent things happening, things with timescales, court proceedings, meetings that they really need to be a part of. It's hard to kind of keep those people on a waiting list. So I do find that I will pick them up.
The need does change, though. If you look at I might say I have 25, but I'm only actively right now working with 10 because the rest are, things are going well and nothing's happening.
Right.
And the other ones are in court or they're going through a big, there's reviews and conferences with the local authority. So it kind of, it changes a lot. And I think with my population, I have quite a few lifers on my caseload that don't need intensive support on a weekly basis, but they know that they can always turn to me and come and see me when there's something that happens. So I won't necessarily close a case because nothing's happening. It'll kind of remain there. And when I walk on the wing, she can stop me and come and see me if she just wants a chat that she doesn't feel like is, about something specific. We can just have a chat and be there for her if she's struggling a little bit.
Yeah. And then obviously the sort of cutoff legally is 18, but how does that work in practice? Is it like you've turned 18 now, bang, we can't really do anything more, or is it until the day before their 19th birthday?
So this is the beauty of us not working for the local authority. We don't have to follow that specific rule of you're 18 now, you don't sit under our service anymore. I'm supporting a mum who has a 20-year-old son. She lost contact for about 13 years and has regained contact through me reaching out to social services. So I'm not going to stop supporting her because that's still her child.
Yeah, and she's still a mum who has a child.
Exactly.
And it's sort of,
there are some departments within social services that are a little bit more transitional.
Yeah.
So they will provide support to children as they transition into adulthood, be that through things like personal advisors or if they're leaving care. They do have access to additional support through the local authority. But with our work, I think it really is, just like I said, that lack of a criteria at all, really. And we're just able to do what works best for an individual family.
It's
so I'm working. I'm working a case at the moment where there's 5 children. The oldest child is due to turn 18 this summer. And that's causing mum quite a lot of anxiety. She's serving a life sentence. It's causing her quite a lot of anxiety because it's her first child to become an adult. And what does that mean?
Right. And are they all in foster care or are they?
No, none of them are. They're all with different family members.
Okay.
But they are all still in the family, but there is social services involvement. And so there's a lot of anxiety around, what will happen for this child? What will that look like? What will social services involvement look like? And social services have worked with this child for a very, very, very long time. And they've made it quite clear that they will not just be closing the case when he turns 18. There will be continued involvement. And that's something that we've been able to reassure mum about through working together. What's that going to look like? What's support going to look like for this child as he becomes an adult? And how can that information provide mum with some comfort and some sense of control over what's happening as well?
And out of interest, obviously not naming names, but it's interesting, I think, talking about real life women and experiences.
Yeah.
So with those 5 children, do they all come and visit her or just some?
It's a combination. Okay. Yeah, it's a complete combination.
And I suppose it's difficult with the sort of the geography of where people live and maybe where she is. And we know that women get held so far away from home often. And the other element, which I learned about sort of in the last few years, which I suppose I was pretty shocked and surprised that when a child gets removed from a mother in a family court, there is economic support and finances that go with that child to make sure they're okay. But when a child is removed from a mother in a criminal court, no money goes with them. So if a grandma says, okay, I'll take your two boys, I have room, she doesn't get any money to look after those boys. And she might not work if she's grandma, or she might work, but then how does she look after?
No, she can't.
It's staggering. It was Shona Minson's research that I learnt that through.
Mm. Unfortunately, she might get support if it gets to a point that's so bad that she needs social services to become involved, and then they might support financially, but then that's putting that child at risk. So why aren't we doing that straight from the beginning?
Yeah, exactly. So tell me about the pilot and sort of how long that's running for, and what's hoping to be achieved through it. And is it just you two, or are there more people involved?
It's just the two of us.
Right.
I mean, we have managers.
Okay.
But there's just us two in prisons. It's a three-year project, which is ending in December of this year, of 2023. And the goal, the magic wand is... for the MOJ to give us money.
To carry on doing the work that you're doing.
And to put social workers in all of the women's prisons, because the women do need it.
One social worker in each prison? I mean, obviously, that would be a good start. I mean,
that would be a great start.
More would be great, but let's start small.
Exactly. And obviously, as we said, we're only in two prisons at the moment, so it's really difficult for us to make any comment on the scope, you know, the landscape, the demographic of other prisons. Mm-hmm. But I think that would be the conversation that we'd like to open is having a social worker in every women's prison. Mm-hmm. And then, I suppose, like you said, working up from there.
If you look at both of our prisons, with the amount of people that are in there and the remand, the lifers and all of that, I could use just the one social worker, and Becky, you could use more,
right?
I think based on the women's prison, every prison will have different needs. Do they have another baby unit? Do they have, you know, so it's all very dependent. Depending on that.
I think that's something that we've really observed, haven't we, as the pilot's gone on, is if this were to be rolled out, each job in each different prison could look very different in terms of, like you said, the facilities at each prison, the demographic, the geographical location that it covers, all of those things, really.
So how will you prove your case at the end
of... Well, we're working with Cardiff University right now, aren't we?
Yeah.
They're doing an evaluation on our project.
So we've had that evaluation since the start of the pilot, which is really geared towards proving, do you know what I mean, proving ourselves, proving the worth of the project of having social workers in prison, which isn't, it's not easy. It's not a system that was designed for social workers.
It's not a business, is it, where we have to put down numbers and stuff. When you talk about real life people, it's very hard to prove where the money is going.
Also, I was having this conversation with a police officer the other day. You can't prove what you've prevented.
Yeah.
And all of us who work in the prevention space, which is so many of us, it's impossible.
Yeah.
And then, of course, you have the quantitative data and the stats. Fine if you can get them, and that's what most people want. But then the qualitative data, people can tend to be a bit sniffy about. But quite frankly, that's really important data too.
Yeah.
But again, it's very difficult to get all that down when you're actually doing the job and having to, you know, get it all done.
If we looked at 5-10 years down the road and seeing the impact that our work has had on the children that we were supporting, then that might be completely different. But unfortunately, we don't have that time. We can't do that. But if you think about the amount of children that we've supported over the last just the 2 years of us being in prison and how they are having contact with their moms, and their family unit is better than ever, and they can go to school and say, yeah, my mom's in prison and that's fine because I see her and I speak to her and they don't get bullied. If you look at those things, that's where we see that there is such an impact.
Or like I said, the alternative being where we've been able to help and contribute towards a sense of closure, or even just like a little semicolon. Do you know what I mean? Where we can pause and we can say, okay, we can leave this in a place now. We've done all of this work. We've shared all this information. You know, we've supported each other to understand both sides of the situation, and we can break now, or we can close this chapter and maybe revisit it later down the line, or or move on in whatever way that looks like. I mean, we're big parts of adoption proceedings at times. We facilitate final contacts, we supervise contacts, but sometimes, like I said, a big part of that is helping mum after that's happened. And they said there's other services that are out there that can do that, but bringing that into a prison is difficult.
Yeah.
It's difficult to bring community services in.
Yeah. Not impossible, not I always impossible. Think. Because I'm old enough to remember 20 years ago when there used to be way more sort of third sector organisations and community services that did, you know, just in Brixton Prison, there used to be a huge amount going on there. So it's sort of possible, obviously made more difficult by the fact we've got a recruitment and retention crisis going on in the prisons as
and
well.
And I do think as well, generally, it is a population that I do think is often missed and not talked about. I mean, I think there's been a few cases that I've worked with social services where, and, you know, this isn't about, you know, social services are this or that. I've worked with some absolutely fantastic social workers in some cases where we've been able to work together to produce some incredible outcomes for children and families. But we've also worked cases where there's been a lot of challenge and difficulty. And I do think that I've had some really honest and open conversations with social workers in the local authority who have said to me, I don't work cases like this often.
Yeah.
I'm not sure like the best way to approach this. I'm not sure how to involve mum, even if I could. Like, what would that look like? And sometimes the perception is that when someone is in custody, their risk becomes static. They're not out in the community. They're not around the child consistently. There's no concerns about them coming and trying to pick the child up from school or turning up at the house that they're staying at. And so sometimes they're not included as a positive factor, but they're also not perceived as an entirely negative factor at that point, because the risk that they present to the child is diminished by them being in custody.
What you've just said has made me remember, I had a social worker come into the prison to meet one of the prisoners, and when she left, she said, I didn't expect her to be like that. She was quite lovely. And I just thought, well, what did you expect? That she'd be some feral, angry person just because of the offence that she now has on her forehead.
But that is what people do, don't they?
Yeah.
They make judgment based on that.
I think there's a part of it that's slightly true, because if I look at just my experience in the near decade of working for the local authority before this job, I worked with one prisoner. So they don't see that a lot. And you don't know how the prison works, and you don't know what a prisoner is.
Yeah, so and you sort of forget that actually that prisoner that they're now labelled was just a member of the community before.
Yeah.
And they don't undergo this weird transition when they go through the gate of turning into a three-headed sort of monster, do they?
Yeah.
But of course, we can be led to believe sometimes that that is the case.
I always like to remind myself that, like, all of us here around the table are one decision away from being in prison.
Totally.
And unfortunately, that's just what happens to regular, normal people. And now they're branded prisoners and they lose everything just because of that.
And this is, we talk about this a lot in social work about, like, reflective practice. You know, it's a huge part of what we do, you know, of critical reflection, and really sort of thinking when you're in these different situations, when you're working these different cases, whatever it may be, it's thinking about your unconscious bias and your prejudices and your assumptions. We all have them.
No one's
immune from them. We all have them, and you're only human but it's acknowledging them and it's recognising them, because if you're not recognising them, then you can't prevent them from impacting your work. And we are all human, but we are professionals.
Yeah. You can go home and think what you want, but when you're at work, you got to do the best thing for these people. That's
exactly
just what you sign up to.
Yeah, and that it's really important that that isn't clouded by your own personal judgments or what you read on social media or in the newspaper. It needs to be really, really thoroughly looked at and weighed up, and, like you said, not rooted in this idea that people turn into three-headed, whatever.
Absolutely. And then when we also, you know, I always talk about sort of a harmonious prison, so reducing also the levels of self-harm and the violence and the potential suicides, and which obviously impacts the staff so much. You know, I imagine the job that you do goes a long way to preventing women from getting to that place where they feel so helpless and they're so in the unknown, they're not getting answers from people, and you're helping them to navigate that. And actually, I think from the experiences I've had of working in different prisons is that the more troublesome prisons were the ones where there was no communication. and the women knew nothing. And they kept, you know, they'd jump on members of staff to be like, come on, tell me what's happening with this thing. And the staff were like, oh God, they're just so needy. I don't have the time. And, you know, it's just like, gosh, just a bit of controlled communication would really change this prison dramatically.
It's building a team around that person, isn't it? You have to bring all the departments, whether that's officers, healthcare, the chaplaincy team, social workers, everyone, bring them around and say, this is what's going on. It might not be the answer that you want. It might be really traumatic, but we're all here to support you. And at least you know. And if you know, then you can cope with that and you can move forward.
And it's multi-agency working, isn't it? Which time and time again comes up as being, you know, one of the key issues in most things that go wrong. You know, you look at any serious case reviews, multi-agency working is usually in there in some form. It's about everyone coming together and playing their part and then communicating that back. And I think we see a lot of reacting in custody. It's a lot of reacting to things that happen. And it's about, I think, us all trying to work together before there's something to react to. But it's difficult. It is hard, and I understand that. I think everyone's sort of still working on trying to understand what the best way is to
And communication is one of the hardest things, isn't it? In every organisation, every institution, it's just something that needs to be worked on all the time. And this idea of having social workers in prisons came from Lord Farmer's review, didn't it?
Yes, it did, yeah.
So I guess that doesn't necessarily mean it's going to happen because it is a recommendation. And we all know that these reports get written, recommendations get written, and then you have to fight tooth and nail, usually over decades, in order to try and get the government to implement the things that they say would be a good idea. So will a report be written that people will be able to, or I'll be able to see at the end of it?
Yeah. There's an interim report about our project and sort of the findings at the halfway point, which was done last summer.
Yeah, around June.
Yeah, so that was put out last summer, and there will be another one sort of at the end.
Well, listen, it's been great talking to you both. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Good luck with it.
I'll be rooting for you in December.
Thank you.
And let us know if we can help in any way at all.
Links relevant to this episode can be found in the pod notes below. If you enjoyed listening, we would love it if you would subscribe. Also, rate, review, and best of all, share this episode. Justice is produced for One Small Thing by the London Podcast Company.
Burrow is a furniture company known for timeless design and thoughtful construction, and free shipping, and that extends to their outdoor collection. Their outdoor furniture is built to withstand the elements, featuring rust-proof stainless steel hardware, weather-ready teak, and quick-dry foam cushions. For Memorial Day, get 15% off your Burrow purchase at burrow.com/acast, and up to 25% off outdoor. That's up to 25% off outdoor furniture at burrow.com/acast.
How would you like to look 5 years younger? In a clinical study, people that had volume added with Juvederm Voluma XC in the cheeks perceived themselves as looking 5 years younger at 6 months after treatment. Look younger, feel like you. Add volume for lift and contour in the cheeks with Juvederm Voluma XC. Reverse signs of aging by adding volume to smooth laugh lines with Juvederm Volure XC. For important safety information and to find a licensed specialist, visit Juvederm.com. That's Juvederm.com. Not for people with severe allergic reactions, allergies to lidocaine, or the proteins used in Juvederm. Common side effects include injection site redness, swelling, pain, tenderness, firmness, lumps, bumps, bruising, discoloration, or itching. There's a risk of unintentional injection into a blood vessel, which can cause vision abnormalities, blindness, stroke, temporary scabs, or scarring. Talk to a licensed specialist to find out if it's right for you.
This is Paige, the co-host of Giggly Squad, and I want to tell you about a company that I've been loving, Olive & June. Olive & June gives you everything that you need for a salon-quality manicure in one box. And if you break it down, it really comes out to $2 a manicure, which
is absolutely insane. It's also so easy to get salon-worthy nails at home with Olive & June. The difference between how your nails used to look when you did them yourself and now with the Manny system is a complete game changer. The best thing about Olive & June, too, is it's a quick dry. It dries in about 1 minute, lasts for 5 days, and full coverage in up to 1 to 2 coats. Visit oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system. That's oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system.
Here's a cool fact. A crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Another cool fact, you can get short-term health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans are designed for people who are between jobs, coming off their parents' plan, or turning a side hustle into a full-time gig. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. Get more cool facts about UnitedHealthcare short-term plans at uh1.com.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.